This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, episode number 653. How did you like that last episode with Danielle DiMartino Booth, who was formerly with the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas? She was interesting. If you didn't listen to that one yet, you'll want to go back and do that because it dovetails very nicely into today's episode, where our guest will be my wonderful mother. She is back on the show. Mom, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, Jason.
I think this is your fourth or fifth time on the show, and pretty much every time you've been on, I've had to twist your arm to get you to come on the show.
Well, I'm not used to it exactly, so that's why.
This is not your thing, huh?
Not exactly.
Well, thanks for being here. As we talk about, now you are excited about our upcoming trip to Jekyll Island, and we've had G. Edward Griffin on the show a couple of times now over the years, who wrote the very famous book, which is really considered the magnum opus on Jekyll Island, on the Federal Reserve System, on fractional reserve banking, on the banking cartel, the Rothschild family. There's so many aspects to this. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. Gosh, I can't even remember all the names of these organizations. What's the one I'm not thinking of? It's a big one. The Council on Foreign...
The International Monetary Fund?
No, I mentioned the IMF. No, this is the one I was thinking of was the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations.
Oh, yeah.
The CFR. Yeah, the CFR. See, you're an expert. And you are just into this book. You're 200 pages into it. I read it many years ago, and what I didn't know until I started talking to you about it last week is that it was updated. This is the fifth edition of the book, and I don't think I realized this because he did the original printing back in 1994, and the fifth edition came out in 2010, but the last printing of it was the 39th printing run in 2015 in July. So it's been updated, and it was important that G. Edward Griffin update the Creature from Jekyll Island book because we had the big financial crisis in between there, and a lot has changed. And so this is very interesting. So we're doing our trip to Jekyll Island, Georgia in May, Mother's Day weekend. And Mom, I'm glad you're coming. This is going to be great. So tell us what you think about this book.
Well, I never thought the Federal Reserve was very interesting until I started reading this book. And it just, some of the statements that Mr. Griffin makes are really very interesting. For example, right at the beginning of the book, he said the Federal Reserve System should be abolished. Now, I always thought the Federal Reserve System was there for the protection of the United States, for the protection of the, you know, all of us citizens, you know, to make everything stable, because I read some book that they ran out of money at one time in New York, and I think it was J.P. Morgan had to put all of these men in a room, lock the door, and he wouldn't let them out until they came up with a solution so that some of the institutions wouldn't fail. So
that was the lender of last resort concept. And that's what the Federal Reserve filled in. It did that. But yeah, it's just an...
I think that's why they finally decided to establish something
right,
like that.
Right, right. And you know, these things are always sold if they're for our benefit, whether it be any law, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, they always have to sell it to the people.
But it is never, ever that way. That is never the truth of the matter. So anyway, this book just grabbed me from the very beginning, because he said that the Federal Reserve was incapable of accomplishing its public objectives, which were not its real objectives. He said it's a cartel operating against the public interest. It's a supreme instrument of usury. It generates our most unfair tax. It encourages war. It destabilizes the economy. And listen to this. It is an instrument of totalitarianism.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. One of the things many people don't understand is how the Federal Reserve is a taxing entity, because the tax it uses is a very subtle tax that very few people pay much attention to or even understand, and that is the hidden tax, the pickpocket, the liar, and the thief, known as inflation. And they also don't understand how the Federal Reserve and other central banks — the Federal Reserve, by the way, is not the only one, that's just the biggest central bank, that's the central bank for the United States — but the ECB, the European Central Bank, the Central Bank of Japan, these big central banks around the world are all in this game. And it is just a monumental cartel, and it causes war. It kills people, this cartel, and people do not really understand that. I didn't even have any understanding of this from my economics class in college. Really, I didn't get any understanding of this until maybe 2003, when I first discovered this book. And then I really started paying attention to it in about 2005 or six. So,
well, I just think, why wasn't this man the author of some of those textbooks?
Well,
really?
Yeah. It doesn't work that way, because guess who funds the colleges and schools? The government. And the government is in bed with the central bank. So you're never going to get this real education there, right? Of course not. And of course, schools and universities are hugely left-leaning institutions. So you'll never get free market ideology very much from them. But just so you know, listeners, G. Edward Griffin is coming back on the show for another visit, and I am interviewing him on April 20th. So that's coming up pretty quick. And he's been on several times before. If you want to hear him from the past episodes, just go to jasonhartman.com and type Creature from Jekyll Island, or just Creature, because that's not a word we commonly use on the show. And I'm sure you'll find it. It's in the search bar at jasonhartman.com. And I've got a few fascinating interviews with G. Edward Griffin on the show before, but he'll be back on. And I want to have him really, Mom, this time he's going to talk about the financial crisis. I want him to focus on some of the more updated aspects of this and how the Federal Reserve caused the financial crisis. In fact, years ago, I was saying, like, if you're looking for one person to blame, if you could blame one human being for all of the financial mess, it would be the sellout known as Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve chair at the time. Well, directly before, he retired at the perfect time and left Bernanke with the mess. Like, he set it all up, created all the problems, and then he says, well, I'm going to retire. He wrote a book. He went on a book tour. And poor Ben Bernanke had to take all the all of the crap when it hit the fan,
Yeah, but Greenspan didn't believe in the same way that he believed once he got the job as a chairperson.
That's such a good point. Yeah, because Greenspan, interestingly, was part of what's known as the collective. Now, the name is tongue-in-cheek, but Ayn Rand, A-Y-N Rand, one of my very favorite writers. She and Greenspan were buddies. They were good friends. And Greenspan was a gold standard guy. He was an anti-central bank person. He was an anti-inflationist. He was anti-Keynesian. And then he became a sellout, and he just shut up, didn't he, after getting in the cartel?
Well, when he got the job, he could not talk like that.
Yeah, right, yeah. So everyone has their price, don't they?
Yes.
Well, tell us more about what you've been so fascinated with. This book had you at hello, I guess, right?
Well, then you just flip over a page or two, and he said that the Federal Reserve System is not federal, and there are no reserves, which is amazing. And also, it's not even a bank. So then...
you're looking for that.
He started talking about what happened on this very cold night in November of 1910. He said that there were six men who met at this railroad station, and they got into this very, very, very luxurious car owned by Nelson Aldrich, who was the Republican whip of the Senate. He was chairman of the National Monetary Commission, and he was a business associate of J.P. Morgan, and he was the father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller, Jr. So as a congressman, as a senator, he was very well connected. Another person that evening was Abraham Andrew. He was the Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. He was Frank Vanderlip, who was president of National City Bank in New York, which was the most powerful bank at the time, representing Rockefeller and Kuhn, Loeb & Company. There was Henry Davison. He was a senior partner at J.P. Morgan. There was Benjamin Strong, who was head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And finally, there was a man by the name of Paul Warburg. He was also a partner in Kuhn Loeb, but he was representing...
And Warburg was the bright guy, right? He was the brightest one,
yes,
I think.
He was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England, and he was the one who had the blueprint for setting up the Federal Reserve. So they all got on the train that night, and they traveled 800 miles, I think it was, until they got to, they had a few stops along the way, until they got to Jekyll Island in Georgia. And there in that famous hotel, the Jekyll Island Hotel, was where they devised.
And that's where we are staying, by the way.
Yes, I can't wait. I can't wait. And also, just a very interesting side note, they say there are a lot of ghosts at Jekyll Island.
Mom, you're scaring people away. I want to get people to come.
No. but it's very interesting. According to one of the employees, none of the ghosts are harmful at all, but they just provide another whole interesting aspect to
the
hotel.
Here's what the ghost at the Jekyll Island Hotel and Club, where we are staying for the Venture Alliance Mastermind meeting. And listeners, you can come as a guest. Okay, if you're not a Venture Alliance member, you're welcome to join us as a guest. These Venture Alliance trips are first class, okay? Whether we were in Dubai or San Diego or Newport, Rhode Island, now we're going to be in Jekyll Island for our fourth adventure. We call it the Adventure Alliance as well as the Venture Alliance, kind of a play on words. And the ghost at the Jekyll Island Hotel and Club, here's the one thing they do besides drink your coffee, which you told me about that. They pickpocket you very slowly by debasing the value of the dollars in your pocket. They're inflation ghosts. They're the ghosts of inflation.
Well, anyway, I think you should know the reason why those six men got together. I mean, it wasn't just to go duck hunting. And they were all told that this was a very, very, very secretive meeting. And as a matter of fact, some of these men were competitors of each other in business. And if the public had ever gotten wind of the fact that all of these very, very important men who were competitors were meeting together, you know, they would have thought something was really, really up. But what was happening was that in 1910, the banks in the United States were growing at a phenomenal rate. They more than doubled in just 10 years. And most of these banks were being set up in the South and in the West. And that would mean that they were taking a taking away the business from those very rich, wealthy New York bankers. And also there was a big competition to not even go to the banks to fund new business. They would just fund expansion of their business out of their current profits. And so the banks thought, my word, you know, we're going to be reduced to unimportant people and unimportant banks if we don't do something about it. So that was a major, major reason why they decided to meet. But then another huge reason was that the greatest threat to all banks always comes from a run on the banks by the public. If the public gets nervous about the banking system, you know, they will all go and demand their money at the same time.
That's why they have something called bank holidays, which, interestingly, you know, I didn't realize, Mom, that the last bank holidays were not during the Great Depression. We had bank holidays much more recently. I didn't know that.
Oh, we had one during the savings and loan thing in Ohio.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was reading in the book. Yeah, you've got me reading this book again too.
Well, the details. He's, you know, Griffin says you can whip through the book very quickly by just reading the major part, the beginning of the chapter, and then you can go to the summary. But the interesting part of the book is all of the information in between before you get to the summary. So that's why I like to read the whole thing.
He really tells the story very well. Yeah, he does. Now, you know what's interesting about these bankers meeting like that is that you would consider this, I mean, if this happened, well, if people knew about it, they would have shouted and demanded that this is a violation of antitrust laws, where these big bankers are basically meeting to have a conspiracy, if you will, to fix prices. That's what they would normally say. But this is so convoluted and complicated that it's not like price fixing. It's not like they got together and said, well, if you're only paying your depositors 3% interest, then let's all agree none of us will pay more than 3% interest. And then when we loan money, we'll charge everybody 10% interest and nobody can charge less. That would be antitrust law violation. It would be price fixing. That's illegal. Similarly, if you get together and say, let's all gang up on our competitor and run them out of business, that's a violation of antitrust laws too. That's illegal. And, you know, you can be imprisoned for it. But what they did here, and the antitrust laws, I'm sure weren't as developed then because that was right on the heels of the industrial magnates and where we had the trust busters and all that stuff, or it happened somewhere around there. But now they're much more developed. But even if they did this today, you would not be able to probably even convincingly make the argument that they were violating antitrust laws because it's such a convoluted, difficult to understand concept. Really wrapping your head around this is not easy. It took me a long time to get my head around it. I had countless discussions with friends about these issues that had read this book. I studied lots of things like Chris Martinson's Crash Course. We've had Chris Martinson on the show a couple of times. You can Google the Crash Course or just check out the podcast episodes on Chris Martinson on jasonhartman.com. Great guest. We've had him on recently again, but a long time ago as well. It's just incredible how nuanced and complex this conspiracy is. I remember when I had Bill Bonner, who I think is really one of the most brilliant financial writers of them all, on the show. He said that after decades of researching this and writing about it, he doesn't fully understand it. And I don't think that was just false modesty. I believe him when he says that, and he's far more knowledgeable than I'll ever be on this topic. But yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so anyway, what happened, what emerged from this was a cartel agreement with five different objectives. Now, these were the secret objectives, you know, of the cartel. That wasn't what, you know, they told the public. It was to stop the growing competition from the nation's newer banks. It was to obtain a franchise to create money out of nothing for the purpose of lending. It was to get control of the reserves of all banks so that the more reckless ones would not be exposed to currency drains and bank runs. And it was to get the taxpayers to pick up the cartel's inevitable losses and then to convince Congress that the purpose was to protect the public.
It's always for our good, right?
Wasn't that an amazing plan?
Yeah, what an amazing marketing scheme.
So he makes a statement here. It says the record shows that the Fed has failed to achieve its stated objectives, but that's because those were never its true goals. And as a banking cartel, and in terms of the five objectives, it has been an unqualified success. So,
unfortunately, it has. Yeah, unfortunately, it has.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. Let me share a couple things just in reading this morning I thought were interesting. On page 69, he talks about the abandonment of the free market. And he talks about the government regulation of the, I don't know if this is the S&L industry or the banking industry, can't remember here, of S&Ls. And he says, this is just blew my mind. And this is what happens with virtually all regulation. The cost of it is so high that ultimately, of course, who pays for it? Listeners, understand that businesses, whether they be sole proprietorships, LLCs, corporations, public or private, they are all pass-through entities. They pass everything through to their stakeholders, whether it be their employees, their customers, or their shareholders, okay? It's always a pass-through. So here he talks about that. He says the additional cost, he's talking about the regulation of the banking industry and the S&Ls, right? And he says the additional cost to S&Ls of compliance with this regulation has been estimated by the American Bankers Association at about $11 billion per year. Now, here's the statement that's going to blow your mind, which represents a whopping 60% of all their profits. More than half of their profits goes to pay for regulatory compliance cost. That is insane.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. But think about it. It's not really that incredible if you think about it twice, right? Because all of us listening, in our lifetimes, we will easily pay 60% of our income to some sort of tax, whether it be sales tax, income tax. And remember, there are these excise taxes that you don't really notice, okay? Like on gasoline, for example. And they're taxed by the quantity, not the price. Now, wasn't it smart for the government to do that on the gas tax? And I don't remember what it is, but I want to say, forgive me if I get this totally wrong, listeners, but I'm just going to throw it out there, that gas tax was like 29 cents per gallon. So what they did by doing a tax like that is they probably viewed it the same way as they view what they call the core inflation rate. So the core rate of inflation, as listeners, you know, I've talked about this many times, excludes two vital areas of life and spending. It excludes the cost of food and excludes the cost of energy. And the reason their justification for this is they said, well, you know, food and energy, they're just too volatile. So we have to take them out to get a more even keel measurement. And that's probably exactly what they did with gas tax, because they tax it by the gallon, not by the price. So they don't care about market fluctuations. You're still going to pay the government something like 30 cents a gallon, right? No matter what, which represents far more than those evil oil companies that, by the way, don't seem to be so evil now that they're all going broke, right? That Hillary Clinton over the years has bitched about and says, we need a windfall profits tax for these evil oil companies. When even back then, the government was making more from a gallon of gasoline than the oil companies were. I mean, how can you, So how can these people say this with a straight face? It's unbelievable.
But they do all the time with a straight face.
I know
face.
They do, because they're criminals. Hillary is certainly a criminal. We know that.
Definitely.
But it's just mind-boggling. It really is. So what else do you think? You know, the next thing he talks about is, I love this part, by the way. The next subchapter is insurance for the common man, ? And it says this is great. He says the average private savings deposit is about $6,000, which, a little side note on that, listeners, if you're listening to this, I'll bet you have a lot more than $6,000 in the bank. Hopefully not too much more, because you've invested most of your money and it's not sitting in the bank earning negative interest rates, right? But G. Edward Griffin, that's my comment. G. Edward Griffin goes on to say, yet under the Carter administration, the level of FDIC insurance was raised from $40,000 to $100,000 for each account. Those with more than that merely had to open several accounts, so in reality, the sky was the limit. Clearly, this had nothing to do with protecting the common man. The purpose was to prepare the way for brokerage houses to reinvest huge blocks of capital at high rates of interest virtually without risk. It was, after all, insured by the government. And so then he goes on to talk about the rates, and I'll just read a little bit more. He says, in 1979, Federal Reserve policy had pushed up interest rates, and SNLs had to keep pace to attract deposits. By December of 1980, interest rates, or he says they were, 15.8% interest on their money market certificates, yet the average rate they were charging for new mortgages was only 12.9%. Many of the older loans were still crunching away at 7 or 8%. And to compound the problem, some of those were in default. Now, that's mind-boggling, right? Think of what has to happen there. You can put your money in a money market and get 15.8%, yet you have an old mortgage at 7 to 8%. This is so imbalanced, you can't even make this stuff up. It's like fiction, right? And to compound the problem, some of those were in default, which means they were really paying 0%. The thrifts were operating deep in the red and had to make up for the difference somewhere.
Oh, Jason, I remember those huge, wonderful interest rates, because that's how I so quickly put together the money to open that terrible Pioneer Chicken store.
Right. Yeah. I remember too. Okay. I was your kid. And I remember exactly what you said. You said you had Dean Witter, that was the name of the firm. You had Dean Witter money market accounts, and you were earning like 16% interest or something ridiculous like that.
15 or 16. It was just amazing how quickly it happened. And my assistant, I kept telling Pam, put your money in one of those money market accounts. And she steadfastly refused to do that. You know, I just couldn't.
Because she wanted to buy a new car.
I don't know why. She just thought it was that your money would disappear from there, that it wouldn't be legitimate.
Well, just a little comment on that, by the way, and I think you probably know this now, but money market accounts are not insured. And those, you can lose your money in money. Most people think of them just like a bank account, which really, as he talks about in the book, and I've talked about on the show many times, the bank accounts aren't insured either in real life, because it says they'll give you $250,000 worth of insurance. But if we were to have a banking crisis, there is no way the FDIC can come even close to paying for the deposits. And I've cited articles and sources, Zero Hedge, et cetera. I think Shadow Stats too, shadowstats.com. We had John Williams on the show, the founder of that site, before. And don't expect that money to be truly insured if there's a really big crisis. Because when Peter Schiff was on the show, and I certainly have my arguments with Peter Schiff, believe me, it's like a love-hate relationship, but he is right about a lot of things. And one of the things he said when we had him on the show during the thick of the crisis, during the ugliest, darkest days of the financial crisis, and he said, look, Jason, the FDIC insurance limit may have been increased to $250,000, and they'll give you back your $250,000 because they can just step in and print money. But he said this, and I thought it was very bright the way he said it. He said, the only question is, what will the $250,000 be worth when you get it? In other words, the value will be inflated away.
Right.
And so, it's mind-boggling. It really is. Mom, do you have another comment on the book? Or I want to read something to the listeners here and maybe close with this thought about taxes and why they're not even necessary.
Well, the thing that was very interesting to me was what happened to people when they can't pay the interest, and how the bank just keeps rolling it over and rolling it over. And the idea is that the loan should never be paid off because it will end the person's or the bank's income, that fabulous stream of interest that they get from those loans. And any bank manager that would write off a loan, they say, would soon find himself without a job, because that is just not the thing to do. It's a whole interesting situation, and Griffin calls it, the name of the game is bailout. So what happens is that because of the fact that there's the FDIC and the Federal Deposit Loan Corporation, they now guarantee these massive loans made to large corporations and to other governments. They will not be allowed to fall entirely upon the bank's owners should those loans go into default. This is done under the argument that if these corporations or banks are allowed to fail, the nation would suffer from vast unemployment and economic disruption. Remember, that was one of their goals. That was one of the things that they would tell the public if a loan got into trouble. And so the end result is that the banks have very little motive to be cautious, because they are protected against the effect of their own folly. And the larger the loan, the better it is, because it will produce the greater amount of profit with the least amount of effort. And they say that a loan to a third world country netting hundreds of millions in dollars in annual interest is just as easy to process as the loan to the local merchant for $50,000. If the loan defaults, the federal government will protect the public. If the little guy fails, nobody protects the bank, against that. The bank has to take that loss. So the individual and the small businessmen find it very difficult to borrow money at reasonable rates, because the banks can make much more money on loans to corporate giants and to foreign governments. And the bigger loans are safer for the banks, because the government will make them good even if they default.
I wanna recommend, in addition to that movie 99 Homes, which I told you about on the last episode, you must see that. And of course you must see The Big Short, but you must also see a documentary about the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, and about the country Jamaica. And it's called Life and Debt. Not Life and Death, Life and Debt. It is on Netflix, or at least it was years ago. I'm sure it's probably still there. And it's very interesting, and it talks about how these huge organizations, which are controlled by the banking cartel, they loan money to these third world countries, and they just impoverish them more and more. They come in and they say, hey, look, we'll loan you money to build roads or a water treatment plant or whatever. And the loans are so onerous. It's really predatory lending, which is what we heard about so much from Barney Frank during the financial crisis. And of course, Barney Frank has absolutely zero experience in banking or business, for that matter, but you can't make this stuff up. It's like, I mean, Bernie Sanders has no concept of how any marketplace works, period. He's an interesting guy, but it's just, these people live in fantasy land. They just don't know how things work in real life and how people's motivations affect things. They think they can just legislate it all. But yeah, Life and Debt, really good. Check it out. It's interesting. Mom, can I share this last thought here from page 203 of the book?
Yeah.
And I've talked about this on the show before, and this is the concept. And there was a somewhat famous essay written on this years ago. I talked about it a long time ago on the show, and I can't remember the name of it or anything, but it was on the same idea. And this subchapter in The Creature from Jekyll Island is called Taxes Not Even Necessary. And it goes on to say, and this is the thing. See, when in the system we have, and coincidentally, the IRS was created, that's another creature from another place, but it's wherever it started, creature from Washington, D.C., probably, I guess, is the origins of the IRS. It was started right around the same time the Federal Reserve was founded, okay? And these two work together to just control and manipulate the population. And you don't need both of them. If you want to tax people and raise money for a government, you only need one of these two entities. You don't need both, because you can tax people either through taxes, which we all understand real well, send the IRS a check or the Department of the Treasury a check, right? Or you can inflate the value of their money away and tax them through inflation. Inflation is the insidious hidden tax, the pickpocket, the liar, and the thief. And so taxes are not even necessary. So let me just read you a little part of what he says here. It says, "It is a sobering thought that the federal government could now operate, even at its current level of spending, without levying any taxes whatsoever. All it has to do is create the required money through the Federal Reserve System by monetizing its own bonds. In fact, most of the money it now spends is obtained that way. The idea of eliminating the IRS sounds like good news. Remember that the inflation that results from monetizing the debt, if the idea of eliminating the IRS sounds like good news, remember that the inflation that results from monetizing the debt is just as much of a tax as any other, but because it is hidden and so few Americans can understand how it works, it is more politically popular than a tax that is out in the open. Inflation can be likened to a game of Monopoly, in which the game's banker has no limit on the amount of money it can distribute. With each throw of the dice, he reaches under the table and brings up another stack of those paper tokens, which all the players must use as money. If the banker is also one of the players, and in our real world, that's exactly the case, obviously, he is going to end up owning all of the property. But in the meantime, the increasing flood of money swirls out from the banker and engulfs the players. As the quantity of money becomes greater, the relative worth of each token becomes less, and the prices bid for properties goes up." Well, my comment here, isn't that exactly what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do? Those government-sponsored entities that flood the real estate market with money? Isn't that exactly what Sally Mae, what Ginny Mae, what all these frickin' government entities do? I mean, look at what they've done to college tuition. They have flooded that market with money, and guess what? The price of college has gone through the roof. And a similar thing, although not exactly the same, is going to happen with Obamacare, my prediction. Okay? All right. "The game is called Monopoly for a reason. In the end, one person holds all of the property and everyone else is bankrupt. But what does it matter? It's only a game. Unfortunately, it's not a game in the real world. It is our livelihood, our food, our shelter. It does make a difference if there is only one winner, and it makes a big difference if that winner obtained his monopoly simply by manufacturing everyone's money." Isn't that fascinating, saddening, and scary at the same time?
Yeah. So I wish they would just get rid of the tax. I wish the government would read this book also, so that we could get rid of the IRS.
I'm sure many in the government have read this book, but they probably consider it their Bible. I mean, if I ever got to interview Janet Yellen, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, or Paul Volcker, I would ask them about this book and say, I mean, there are many other books that are critical of the Federal Reserve, but this one is It's fantastic. So get a copy of The Creature from Jekyll Island, read it, folks, and join us on Jekyll Island and stay at the same place where the banking cartel was formed back starting around 1910. And I think it'll be a great trip. And I hope you're not scared of the ghost that my mom mentioned. But the Jekyll Island Hotel is gorgeous. I mean, the place is absolutely spectacular. Mom, what do you think of those pictures you saw?
Oh, I loved it. But you know what? Just more than a beautiful place, I think it is always great to stay in a place where such historical things happen, because you can just imagine yourself back into that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're going to have some speakers talking about all this stuff, and it's fascinating. And let me just tie it all in for you before we go. What does this mean to us? What does this have to do with real estate investing? Well, folks, it has everything to do with real estate investing, because when you invest in income property, you align your interest with the banking cartel, and it is a global banking cartel. These are the most powerful entities the human race has ever known. Complain about it, bitch about it, support Ron Paul's old campaign, audit the Fed. I'm sure there will be another one coming up. Someone will do it. Do all of that. That's fine. Get educated about it. That's great. But what you ultimately need to do at the end of the day is you are not going to fight this. It is far more powerful than any one person, no matter who they are. And you must align your interest with their interest so that you can prosper as other people become impoverished. And that's what we teach here on the show, at my live events, at our event in May. You can find out more about that at VentureAllianceMastermind.com. Come and join us and be with your financial friends. Make some new financial friends. Financial friends are a special kind of friends, and they can help you get ahead in life. And that's what the Venture Alliance is all about. So check it out, and talk to your investment counselor if you're interested in coming, and we'd love to have you. And Mom, thanks for joining me on the show today. Isn't it interesting that we thought we wouldn't have much to talk about at the beginning of this episode, huh?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was delightful, Jason.
Yeah, and all 10 of our listeners enjoyed it, I hope. No, just kidding. Our listeners from 164 countries around the world. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. Visit jasonhartman.com. Click on the properties section. Check out the properties there. Check out the software available on the resources page of jasonhartman.com. The G. Edward Griffin interviews when he was on the show before at jasonhartman.com as well. And we will look forward to talking to you on the next episode, just 2 days away.
I've never really thought of Jason as subversive, but I just found out that's what Wall Street considers him to be.
Really? Now, how is that possible at all?
Simple. Wall Street believes that real estate investors are dangerous to their schemes because the dirty truth about income property is that it actually works in real life.
I know. I mean, how many people do you know, not including insiders, who created wealth with stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Those options are for people who only want to pretend they're getting ahead.
Stocks and other non-direct traded assets are a losing game for most people. The typical scenario is you make a little, you lose a little, and spin your wheels for decades.
That's because the corporate crooks running the stock and bond investing game will always see to it that they win. This means, unless you're one of them, you will not win.
And unluckily for Wall Street, Jason has a unique ability to make the everyday person understand investing the way it should be. He shows them a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Yep, and that's why Jason offers a one-book set on creating wealth that comes with 20 digital download audios. He shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches you how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears, and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And this set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered for only $197.
To get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia Book 1, complete with over 20 hours of audio, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.